the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Lisa C. returns to the show this week. Everyone loves her novels, which include Shanghai Girls, Dreams of Joy, and Snowflower and the Secret Fan. Last time Lisa C. was here, we talked about her nonfiction classic, On Gold Mountain. Her latest novel is China Dolls, the story of three Asian women who seek fame and fortune in show business in Depression-era San Francisco. Lisa C., welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me again.
China Dolls, it's a great novel, and I loved it. And it has lots of surprises, and I don't want to, you know, any spoilers on the show here, because everybody listening is going to go out and read the book starting tomorrow. But I do want to ask you about the historic background of your story. Were there real-life counterparts to your China Dolls?
Well, I did interview several of the performers, and I also had access to oral histories that had been done in the late 1970s of about another 25, 30 performers, none of them still living today. So I can't say that there's an exact counterpart to Grace or Helen or Ruby, but a lot of what happens to those characters and certainly a lot of the details come from real people.
Well, so let's get into that a little bit. Start with the World's Fair. Was there really a place where you could go and see nude girls for a couple of dollars and take a
break? Oh, absolutely. So this was for the Golden Gate International Exposition. It was San Francisco's second World's Fair. And the main part of the fair had all of the country pavilions and, you know, gardens and fountains. But then there was another part of the fair called the Gay Way, and it was the kind of carnival area. And you could see, go to the headless woman display and see a sword swallower. And there was a man who used to swallow a neon tube so that you could see his innards lit up. And then Sally Rand, who had made a big splash at the Chicago World's Fair, she then opened a place at this one in San Francisco. And so, yes, it was Sally Rand's nude rodeo. So they wore, little bandanas and a holster and pistols, with those pistols placed at strategic angles so that nothing too naked showed.
Yeah.
And they were nude, but then you could also go to other parts of the fair where you could draw naked women, and you know, they had all kinds of things under the classification of art.
Right. Now, of course, you don't have to go very far in San Francisco to find nude women, but you don't even have to go indoors. I mean, they're all over there. It seemed shocking to me that you could go in 1930. What was 39, was it?
Yes, it opened in 39.
Yeah. But I guess if they have the, if they couch it in art, then that made it okay.
That's right.
And what about the Forbidden City? Was that a real place?
The Forbidden City nightclub was real. There were many, many nightclubs that were in San Francisco Chinatown that had opened really very specifically for the exposition. You know, everybody was anticipating a lot of tourists coming to San Francisco, and in fact they did, and wanted to provide nightlife for them. But the Forbidden City was the first Chinese-American nightclub to actually be outside of a Chinatown. So it was just a few blocks away from the Chinatown proper. And that few blocks made a big difference, I think, for who came to the shows and who performed at the shows, what was served, what people drank.
Well, who did come and what was served?
It was a mostly Caucasian audience, and they had two menus. They had the Chinese side of the menu and the American-style food on the other side of the menu, and then these drinks that had, very kind of humorous names that I'm not thinking of right now. But I think the biggest difference that happened at the Forbidden City was that he got the top acts. This is Charlie Lowe, who was the owner and also the MC each night. And this was a man who, his own daughter said, he really knew how to work a room. So he would really, he was the first person, apparently anywhere, to take the microphone out into the audience and interview people and talk to people as customers.
Hmm.
Now, of course, that's very commonplace, but back then he was the very first to do it for any type of nightclub. And he not only brought in people who were the top stars, but he really played with the stereotypes of the day. So, you know, in those days, Chinese were supposed to not have a sense of humor, not be able to dance. They had knock knees or bowl legs, you know, that whatever it was, they had all of these reasons why they couldn't be performers. And the girls were so demure, and women were kept inside. And so sometimes these acts would start with everybody dressed in very somber Chinese clothes, and the women, again, acting very demure. And then a few bars into the music, they would strip off those outer clothes, and underneath they would have just their chorus girl outfits with the fishnet stockings and, you know, put on top hats and go tap dancing across the floor.
Oh, it sounds like fun. I wish I could go.
I know.
How long did that nightclub exist?
It actually stayed in business almost until 1970. Of course, it had gone through a lot of changes by then, and it had even changed hands. The heyday was during World War II, when San Francisco was a big Liberty port, and so all the men who were shipping out to the Pacific, all the men coming back from the Pacific, would pass through San Francisco. And, you know, what a young men who may not have another tomorrow want? Wine, women, and song. Maybe not in that order, maybe in that order. And but then after the war, and people, you know, the boys came home, they got married, they moved to the suburbs, that this, they bought televisions. And this really marked the beginning of the end of all nightclubs. Even, you know, the big nightclubs in New York was the introduction of television, and just how people's lives changed, and how they spent their free time, how they spent their entertainment time, and how they spent time with their families. Instead of going out to a club, you stayed home and watched TV and watched Ed Sullivan, things like that. The final demise of the nightclubs, though, was the late 1960s. And as one performer put it to me, you know, hippies didn't need to go see girls dancing. It wasn't their idea of a good time to see girls in top hats tapping across the floor.
Where were their tastes, those hippies? I don't know what they were. What did they want to see? They didn't want to see that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but Grateful Dead, maybe, in those days. You know, it's a different scene.
Now, did the performers that had populated the Forbidden City and other nightclubs, the Asian performers, show up on the Ed Sullivan Show and the Hollywood Palace and things like that?
Well, yes. There was one couple, Trudy and Larry Long, who he's passed away, and in fact she just did too, about 10 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I did interview Trudy, and they were the first Asians at all, but also a couple to appear on Ed Sullivan. And you know, there's tape of that, and I saw it, and it that also sort of followed that original formula of being dressed in Chinese clothes, and then they would speak to each other in totally fake Chinese. It just sounded Chinese, but it was completely fake. And then they, you know, dropped those outer costumes and were dressed in very sort of 1950s dresses. She had a big petticoat, you know, just looked completely different, and spoke in perfect English. And so all of that other stuff was just a kind of a funny facade that they did that played with the stereotypes.
So they were pioneers in
they definitely were.
Yeah. Now, one of your characters, Lisa C., in your new novel, China Dolls, one of your characters does a dance with a bubble and
mm-hmm.
not much else. Is that modeled on a real dance?
Well, it's modeled on a real dance, and on a, you know, first it was done by Sally Rand, and then there was a woman, Noelle Toy, who actually worked for Sally Rand while she was in college. She went to UC Berkeley, and while she was in college, she, you know, This was how she earned a living. And then later she worked at the Forbidden City and then went all over the country, actually, with mostly with her bubble, but also with fans. And I knew Noelle. She, as an older woman, she passed away a couple of years ago. She eventually retired to Los Angeles and became a real estate agent. Mm-hmm. One thing, it never mattered what time of day I ran into her, morning, noon, at night, she always wore floor-length sequined gowns. She was a, you know, she was a star till the end.
And she danced around with a bubble.
When she was younger.
Wow. And, you know, one of the things I liked about your novel was, and again, I'm not going to give anything away, but one of this girl who dances with the bubble, there's another girl who has to put on her body makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, you know, you don't think about that when you think about a performer doing something like that, that someone has to help them
right.
put on their little strategically placed patch and makeup. So did you have to do some research into the show business aspects of it?
There were a lot of things like that that I had to look into and things about costumes. And earlier I said fishnet stockings, but they didn't actually call them fishnet stockings back then. They were called opera hose. And, you know, but I ended up saying fishnet stockings in the book because I don't think anybody knows what opera hose are. But there were a lot of things like that. There were people who told me how they made their own gowns and what went into making the gowns and how much they cost and for different, elements and sewing on this also before the time of fabric that comes pre-sequined, so that they would sit there and sew on all of their own sequins. So a lot of stuff like that. I met one of the costume designers, and he was just full of all kinds of information, including a lot of very funny stories about wardrobe malfunctions.
Well, yeah, you know, you see these beautiful costumes, and you don't think of all of the things that are involved in getting into the costume,
mm-hmm.
getting out of it, and so forth. What about those fingernails? One of your characters has really long
yes.
fingernails. Was that something that somebody had really made?
Yes, there was a woman named Jadine Wong, who was a dancer, and she was known far and wide for her extra long fingernails. People can look her up on the internet, and you can see them.
It's such a beautiful image in the story, and I think how impractical to have such gigantic
yes.
long. We're talking with Lisa C., and her latest novel, which I love, is called China Dolls. It was really I can't imagine that they're not going to make a movie or a miniseries or something out of this one.
Well, that would be a lot of fun. I can tell you what some people have already said to me, which shows that as much as we think things have changed, they, you know, still remain the same, which is how are you going to find young Asian American women who can sing and dance?
Oh, yeah, that would be impossible.
And have recognizable names, you know, could open a picture, would be enough to carry a television miniseries, which to me seems pretty ridiculous, but I'm not the one who owns the network.
Well, you know, when they had, I'm sure you remember, but when Roots was on TV, whenever they had the previews for Roots, you know, saying that it was coming on and you got to watch it, they always had all of the, they had, you know, like a Lou, what's his name, Ed Asner, and, you know, all the white performers who were in the show,
mm-hmm.
they always showed them prominently in the preview, even
mm-hmm.
though they had absolutely, you know, like 2 seconds in
right.
the, Vic Morrow was in for like 2 seconds, and
right.
he's in the preview. And then that's how they did it. So then they had all these African-American actors that nobody had
mm-hmm.
ever heard of before,
mm-hmm.
who went on to become great stars.
That's right.
That's what's going to happen this coming Sunday, China Dolls
okay.
on NBC. Anyway, one of the interesting aspects of the novel is the racial confusion, I guess. I don't know how to say it.
Well, it falls under they all look alike.
Right.
Is what we could say, yes, that there were actually many performers, Japanese American, actually a few Filipinos, and even a man who was from Portugal, who would change their names to sound Chinese so that they could work in these all Chinese nightclubs. And for some of them, you know, it was, I mean, that was really just a practical reason at the beginning, was if you were Japanese, where were you going to go work if you were a performer? You know, you weren't going to get in the movies. There weren't any Japanese American nightclubs. So this is what you would do, is shorten your name to make it sound Chinese so that you could work at one of those clubs. And for someone as well who, you know, might have been from Portugal, may not have been able to get a job in a white nightclub, but could get a job in one of these other clubs. So that had just a very practical reason at the very beginning. Then during World War II, there were people who had long established their identities. For example, Dorothy Toy was known as the Chinese Ginger Rogers. And nobody came to her, you know, she didn't report herself, she didn't turn herself in to, you know, be rounded up to go to an internment camp, because she had had this identity for a very long time and no one questioned it. But then one of her friends did rat her out, and when the FBI came to Dorothy, they actually gave her a choice. They said, you know, we know you're a big star, so we're going to give you a choice. You can either go to your family in whatever camp that was, or just leave the state of California. And so she spent the rest of the war traveling through the South with her sister, who was a singer, going nightclub to nightclub. And what Dorothy said to me was, they'd never seen a Chinese, they'd never seen a Japanese, they couldn't tell the difference, we knew we'd be safe.
Did Chinese people during World War II wear some kind of identification or something?
Yes, there were. In fact, my own family, they still have some of these pins that you could wear on your, you know, on your lapel, or there were armbands. You could also have placards that you put in your store window, your car window, your home, that said, I am Chinese, and just to make sure that everybody knew who you were and what you were, because certainly in the months immediately following Pearl Harbor, there was a lot, you know, it was pretty dangerous to look Asian.
Yeah, of course, it's one of the saddest and most embarrassing parts of American history was the internment of the Japanese mm-hmm. during World War II. Recently, I visited a school in Monterey County that was this Japanese school. It's this beautiful little monument there now, because the entire Japanese community of Monterey was interned and never came back.
Right. Yeah. Well, the same thing happened here in Southern California. There was a very large Japanese community on Terminal Island, and, you know, after the war, nobody came back. And there's just a couple of buildings left, and they're trying to preserve those so that people can come and see them. But, you know, so many communities, that was the end. And just going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, even after the war, there were plenty of reasons why people would want to have a Chinese-sounding name when they worked in nightclubs, because the war was still fresh in everyone's minds. Certainly the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima were fresh in everyone's minds. And so people didn't want to go to a nightclub and be reminded of any of that. And I have just recently I met a man who came to one of my book events, and he had brought an envelope filled with photographs of his just stunningly beautiful mother, just beautiful woman. And when she came out of the camp, she got a job at the China Doll nightclub in New York, and they changed her name from Enoki to Ding Dong.
How sweet.
I guess it's sweet.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But it shielded her identity.
Well, speaking of that, was the Chop Suey Circuit a real thing, and did they call it the Chop Suey Circuit?
They didn't call it the Chop Suey Circuit in that time. It came to be called that later in retrospect. Mm. But it's similar to the Borscht Belt or the Chitlin Circuit. It was a particular set of clubs that you would go one to the other, city to city, that would invite in Asian acts, Chinese acts in particular.
We're talking with Lisa See and her latest novel, China Dolls, and she's also the author of Snowflower and the Secret Fan and the great nonfiction book On Gold Mountain. The conditions of the internment camps that you described, did you do some research into that?
Oh, yes, a lot of research. Yeah, and, you know, here in Los Angeles, they have the Japanese American National Museum, and they even have a barracks there that has been preserved. But all of that is pretty well documented. It wasn't too difficult for me to find that information, just very current, you know, sort of state-of-the-art information. But I also, when I was growing up, knew a lot of people who had been interned. My grandfather's closest friend, Benji Okubo, an artist, was sent to Heart Mountain. My own grandparents and my father, who was just a little boy, they stayed in the home of the Oki family during the war, and so when the Okies came back out of, they were at Manzanar, out of Manzanar, they actually had a home to return to and still had all of their possessions because my grandparents had you know, taken care of that for them. And then also I had great uncles, I guess they were, who married women who had been in various camps. So I grew up hearing stories about internment and what the different camps were like, but I also wanted to find people who had either been performers or had wanted to be performers and what their stories were so that I could use those and feel like I was being really accurate about that. I mentioned earlier Trudy Long, and she was sent to a camp just very young. She was only 16 years old, and she described what it was like when she arrived, you know, in this terrible dust storm, sandstorm, and what it was like in her particular barracks. But also she was, you know, a young woman, a dreamer, and she loved movies. She loved gossip. She loved nightclubs. She'd never been to one, but she loved the idea of them. And she started writing to the night crawler reporters all around the country saying, will you sponsor me to leave the camp? And someone did. Lee Mortimer from the New York Daily News did sponsor her, and he brought her to New York and got her a job at the China Doll, although she'd never had a dance lesson.
Wow. So it was possible to get out if you had a sponsor.
Yeah. There's another actor named, or he was a comedian named Goro Suzuki, who also was at Topaz. He applied to leave and got permission to go do his act in the Midwest, Chicago, Detroit, you know, all through the Midwest, Cleveland, all through there. When he left the camp, he changed his name to Jack Su.
Oh.
And Jack Su later was the first Asian to have a recurring role on television and on Barney Miller.
Right, right, yeah. He's a wonderful actor, comedian. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was great.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. During World War II, the motion picture industry kind of made a decision, I guess, about how to portray Japanese. I mean, I guess there was some question, well, do we portray them as, you know, innocent people who are being victimized by the military, or in which case then people would have too much sympathy for them. So, I mean, the decision was kind of made to present them as evil people.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that today about how people from the Middle East are portrayed in shows and in films even now? So it's, you know, I think when you have a recognized enemy, quote, enemy, then those are the people who are the evil ones in movies.
It's easier to ask people to go and kill them if you can hate them. But how did that, or how did the, and not only the portrayal of Japanese in the movies, but, you know, the reality of the Japanese invasion of China, how did that affect the relationships between Chinese and Japanese Americans in the era that you write about in China Dolls?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because, you know, there is a difference between the people who are off in another country and your neighbors or your friends or your classmates who you know and have liked for a long time and are your neighbors, for example. There's a difference there. And so I think people, well, the more open-minded people, I suppose, could recognize that difference and could go out and, you know, join picket lines to stop U.S. shipment of scrap iron to Japan. This is before Pearl Harbor, obviously. Or women, Chinese American women had a campaign to try to get other American women to stop wearing Japanese silk stockings. So, and again, that's before Pearl Harbor. After Pearl Harbor, everything changes. But up in those early days, and again, I think most people could tell the difference or could understand the difference between what a country was doing, you know, what Japan was doing by invading China and the rape of Nanking and all of that, and the people who you went to school with or worked with or were your neighbors. That doesn't mean that sometimes there wasn't animosity. Of course, there would, you know, there's always going to be some of that. But I think people were able to tell the difference.
And in your, you mentioned earlier that one of the performers that you were talking about had been turned in by someone.
Mm-hmm.
And was that something that occurred, you know, where people, you know, because of show business rivalries or whatever rivalries or personal reasons?
I think that particular example was more about real just ambition and wanting to get the role. You know, the belief is that Dorothy Toy was turned in by this other woman so that other woman could get the role in the movie.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, hey, listen, I love the novel. How did you... I don't know how to ask this. Did you want to write about this period and therefore you thought about this novel, or did you think about these characters and that's how? How does it happen?
Well, for me, I had known about these clubs for a long time. You know, I think in a way we've all known about these clubs. I mean, everybody who's ever seen Flower Drum Song, right? That's a different time period, but that was also based on the Forbidden City nightclub. It's just set more in the 50s, early 60s. So just very different time, and certainly the musical is, you know, there's a lot of, what would you say today, you know, conflicted feelings in the Asian American community about that.
The racial insensitivity. And the sexist nature.
Right. Of course, it's very, you know, in the play, it's very, very different from the original book, the source material. Well, that's not a big surprise. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that was written by C.Y. Lee. So I had known about these clubs for a long time. I'd known about the performers for a long time. I have a website and people write to me, you know, I like your books. Oh, and by the way, my mother, my grandmother, my father, my uncle, or my grandfather was a performer here. I've attached some photos. So I had a real awareness of it. And then I don't know what it was. I think it was just this sense that if I didn't do the story now, I might not have another chance. If I wanted to actually interview some of those original performers, I could find people who'd performed in the 50s and 60s, but I wanted to find people who'd been there on opening night. And, you know, they're in their late 80s, early 90s, now even late 90s. Dorothy Toy is 97 now.
Wow.
So I felt like if I don't do it, I might not have another chance. And then as far as how those characters developed, I always wanted to have three because I wanted to explore the idea of a set of three friends and how that's really very different than just best friends. We tend to think of three as being very strong. You know, a stool with three legs is stronger than a stool with two. But in fact, NASA has done studies on how to send people into space, should they send three, should they send two, and they finally concluded that it didn't matter if it was men, women, a mixture, that you should always send two at a time because two always gang up on the extra one. So I had actually been thinking about that for quite a while as well, to write about a set of three. And then as how those characters developed, it was really Grace is the most representative of the performers who were out there. Growing up in a small town where the daughter of the only Chinese family in that town, maybe in 100 square miles. And it's amazing. Really, like, the vast majority of the performers had that experience because they had parents who had already broken the mold by moving away from Chinatown, and they were very separated from the culture and traditions and customs. And so these little girls, instead of following the usual pattern, which, you know, you shouldn't show your arms and legs in public, you shouldn't be out on the street by yourself, you should stay home and learn to embroider and knit and cook and take care of children, that just didn't exist out there, you know, if you're completely disassociated from the culture. So Grace is very representative that way. Then Helen is truly just a fictional construct, really, because as far as I could find in all of my research, I never found a single performer, man or woman, who had actually grown up in Chinatown. And so I thought, well, what would it have taken for her family to allow her to dance? What could she have possibly done? What could have been done to her that would allow her family to say, go ahead, dance, we don't care? And then last, Ruby, just because she's the one who's Japanese masquerading as Chinese, and just as we've been talking, you know, over this, in this conversation, that there were quite a few performers who were Japanese, and the reasons why they pretended they were Chinese.
Well, a bunch of readers are going to, and who haven't already, are going to really fall in love with them as they go through this wonderful book. It's called China Dolls, and I love it. And you're going to thank me, people, for telling you to go out and buy it tomorrow. And Lisa C., thank you so much for being with us again on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
That closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and you'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Lisa C. Her great new novel is called China Dolls. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next week.